Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you know your own mind? Although it feels like we are in complete control of the parts of our brain that make decisions and form judgments, a growing body of research demonstrates that we are guided much more by instinct than we consciously realize, to the extent that how we act, where we live, and even who we marry might on some level not be entirely up to our conscious minds. Neuroscientist Dr. David Eagleman is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action and of the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine. His newest book is called Incognito: The Secret Lives of the Brain. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks. Great to be here again, Chris.
We feel very much in control of our brains, but in fundamental ways, it's our unconscious brains that are controlling us. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it turns out that, the brain's the most complicated organ we've ever found in the universe, and it's got these massive operations going on. It consists of hundreds of billions of cells that are connected in such complexity that it bankrupts the English language. And somehow, most of the operations that this massive network is doing runs completely under the hood of our awareness. We're not privy to most of the operations there. And so even though we sometimes think that we're just sort of lazily sitting around, it turns out your brain is always screaming along with activity. And as a result, when you... let's say you think of something. You say, hey, I just thought of something. It wasn't really you, the conscious you, that thought of it. Instead, your brain's been working on that for days or weeks, consolidating information and trying things out and simulating possibilities. And then it serves it up to your conscious brain, and you say, hey, I'm a genius. But it wasn't really you that thought of it. So the analogy that I use in the book is that your conscious mind, which is the part that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning, that part, that's the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain. And the analogy is that the conscious mind is sort of like a stowaway on a transatlantic steamship that's taking credit for the journey without acknowledging the massive engineering underfoot.
Yeah, it made me think about sitting in my office looking things up on the internet, and I have the whole wealth of, billions of people contributing things, not to mention all the technology, and I'm just sitting there clicking around on things, and I feel very smart for coming up with information that way.
that's an interesting analogy. Yeah, that's right. I mean, things, most of our, what we do and how we act and what we believe is generated by other users, in a sense, to follow your analogy, and those just get served up to us. The funny part is how we take credit for it and how we're really good at layering a conscious narrative over our choices. So I heard you mention in the introduction about, for example, who we marry.
Yeah.
That's one of the studies I cite in the book, is this issue of, it turns out that people are statistically more likely to marry other people whose first name begins with the same letter as their first name does. So Joel and Jenny, or Alex and Amy, or Donnie and Daisy, things like that. And you can go through any marriage registry in any county and show yourself that this is true. Now, it's a small effect, but it's statistically verifiable. And this comes about from what psychologists call implicit egotism, which is that we just, we like things that remind us of ourselves and so on. But the point is that if you asked people their conscious story of how they chose their life mate, having the same first letter, that's a terrible reason to choose a life mate. And so it probably wouldn't be part of your conscious narrative, but the effect is actually there. And similarly, people who are named Dennis or Denise are more likely, statistically, to become dentists. And again, it's an unconscious influence given their names and so on, and it wouldn't be part of their conscious story. It turns out these are so common now. We've discovered all sorts of effects like this. By we, I mean the whole community of researchers. For example, if you're holding a warm mug of coffee, you will describe your relationship with your mother as being closer than if you're holding a cold cup of iced coffee. There are all sorts of unconscious ways that we're influenced that we're not even aware of. That doesn't become part of our story of our lives.
So why have we evolved to believe that we're making all these decisions for ourselves. And I guess it's hard to separate our unconscious brain from our conscious brain in terms of what is ourself. But why do we need to think that it's that we're choosing to do these things?
Well, I think it has to do with having the appropriate level of control. So, for example, if you are running a country, what you really want are the newspaper headlines. You want to see, okay, what are the big issues that are going on? You don't want to know what's going on in every single cubicle and every single office building and every factory and who's doing. I mean, what you want to know is, okay, what's the bottom line? And that's the same with the with the conscious mind. So for example, if you were to lift up a cup of coffee to your mouth, that motor action is underpinned by a lightning storm of neural activity. There's a lot of complex stuff happening to allow you to grip that cup right and lift it and aim it towards your mouth and get it there. But all you actually care about is, did I get it there or did I spill the coffee? And so if it weren't for biology, we wouldn't even have any reason to suspect the existence of nerves and muscles and electrical signals and all that lightning storm of neural activity, because all that stuff runs under the hood. And all you want to know is, you know, what's the headline that I need to be aware of? And so the conscious mind, this is a different analogy that I use in the book, is that the conscious mind is like the CEO of a company, in the sense that what a CEO wants to know is, in general, and the CEO is also good at setting the long-term plans for the company and saying, okay, well, here's sort of the long-term vision, how I want the company to be, and then all of the organization below the CEO figures out how to make that happen. But he or she doesn't need to know the details of what's happening behind every closed door. Instead, the CEO just wants to know, look, this is what I want to do, and now make it happen.
How does learning go from being something that is right at the forefront of our consciousness to something that we can do automatically? Things like typing or playing a musical instrument or driving that at first take a lot of effort and pretty soon we can do automatically.
Yeah, so this is a perfect example of the CEO analogy, which is that the CEO says, look, I want to get good at playing the guitar. And so you have whatever social reasons or whatever you want to do that. So maybe you go get a lesson from somebody, and they say, okay, look, you got to hold your wrist more like this and press your fingers harder here and so on. And so you have to use a lot of conscious effort to make that happen. And this is the CEO of the company saying, all right, this is what I want to be true. These are my long-term goals. And what happens is that the process of learning is one of automatizing all of those actions, so that you don't have to think about the G chord and the C chord and so on. Your fingers just start going there. What you're doing is burning the tasks into the machinery of the brain. You're actually reconfiguring the circuitry of the brain to make things happen appropriately. And what the benefit is speed and efficiency, but the cost is that you lose the ability to have conscious access to what you're doing. So once you've automatized something, once the CEO has said, all right, look, I want the company to do this and that, then the CEO eventually no longer has any access to how that's actually getting implemented. So if the CEO says, look, I want all of us to go on, I don't know, on this new email system that puts all our databases together with our email, with this and that, so the CEO makes it happen. But after that's put into place, the CEO says, gosh, I really have no idea how this very complicated system works. I'm just happy that it works.
I was fascinated by the sections that talk about the brain in conflict with itself. And we can all sort of understand this where we can't quite make a decision, or you give the example of a secret that we want to keep. We all have things we don't want anyone to know, and yet our unconscious brains make it really difficult not to unburden ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I got to tell you, this whole thing about thinking about the brain is made up of lots of different pieces and parts was a real revelation to me as I was writing the book. I feel like I was able to figure some things out and put a bunch of ideas together that haven't sort of been clearly stated before in neuroscience. And essentially, the bottom line is that you are not one thing. Your brain is made up of lots of competing parts that are all trying to drive the ship of state. And it's like a neural parliament where you have these different political parties that are battling it out. And so, you know, an example is if I put a piece of chocolate cake in front of you, part of your brain wants to eat that. It's a rich energy source. And part of your brain says, oh, don't eat it, you're going to get fat. And maybe what happens is you end up making a negotiation with yourself, or you get angry at yourself, or you cajole yourself or something. But, you know, the question is, who's talking to whom here? you think it's all you, but in fact, you know, the brain's made up of lots of different drives. And so some of those have to do with short-term impulse gratification. Some have to do with long-term deliberative decision-making. And these are always arm wrestling with each other to steer your behavior. And under different circumstances, the parliamentary vote might tip in different ways. And I think this gives us a much more nuanced way to think about ourselves and other people, because we realize that, you know, people are complicated in this way. Given the same person, they might make different decisions at different times. When faced with temptations that are right in front of them, their parliament tends to tip differently. As opposed to when they're sort of in a more reflective place. And what this means is it's not clear that people have sort of their true colors. I mean, you have sort of on average true colors, but people can be surprising, even to themselves.
Well, you write here about Mel Gibson, who several years ago said some famously horrific things that confirmed for a lot of people, at least in listening, the idea that he was an anti-Semite. And you also look at him later apologizing in a way that appeared sincere. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it means with regard to what we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, when I was watching the Mel Gibson case, I just found it so interesting that that immediately what happened in the media was all of his defenders and all of his detractors. So, you know, his detractors said, look, he said these really anti-Semitic things. He's clearly an anti-Semite, which seemed like a very reasonable conclusion to come to. And then he also had defenders who said, look, Gibson actually has some good friends who are Jewish. In fact, he spent the afternoon with with a couple that's Jewish that are some of his closest friends the same afternoon where he got arrested. And so, and the apology that he gave later in his official letters of apology certainly seemed genuine, and the Anti-Defamation League accepted those apologies. So his defender said, look, he's not really an anti-Semite, he was just drunk. And so I was watching the arguments go back and forth, and I thought, you know, the thing is there any reason for us to insist that one is either an anti-Semite or is not? Or to say, is there any reason to imagine that we can't have racist parts of our brain and non-racist parts of our brain? And this is in no way a defense of his despicable behavior, but it is a way of saying, you know, people can be complicated, and you see this not just with Mel Gibson, but with lots of people, in the way that they say they want to behave, and maybe that conflicts with the way they actually vote when they're in the booth, things like that. And so it turns out that the way to really understand people's behavior is to recognize that you can have completely incompatible belief systems going on within the same head.
So we'll talk about dysfunction and disease later on, but looking at neurotypical brains, does everybody have a similar... are they influenced to a similar extent by unconscious brain function, or are some people more consciously in control of themselves than others?
Well, it turns out that, we summarize a lot under an umbrella of poor impulse control. It turns out that some people have better or worse abilities than others at dealing with the systems of their brain that want things now. And, of course, all children come into the world with essentially only these systems in play. And so, you know, you want something now, and you'll steal a chocolate bar off the shelf, and you'll urinate in public, and you'll say things that are socially inappropriate and so on. And what happens is the process of socialization really has to do with the prefrontal lobes, the part of your brain, you know, just behind your forehead. That's the part of your brain that gets trained up through feedback from your parents and your society telling you, nope, you can't steal the candy bar, you can't expose yourself in public, you can't say inappropriate things. And what happens is as the prefrontal lobes get trained up to your culture, that's what battles against these instant impulse gratification mechanisms.
Dr. David Eagleman is my guest. His new book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Dr. David Eagleman. He is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine and author of the new book Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. So, David, we all trust our conscious minds and we all think our senses are giving us perfect information about the world, but it turns out seeing may be believing, but it is not necessarily reality.
Boy, that's right. It turns out that the whole visual illusion, the whole visual world around you, is really an illusion. Your brain is trapped in total darkness, of course, inside the skull, and all it ever gets are electrical signals that have been transmitted from a lot of processing from your eyes. And from those electrical signals, it constructs, it literally lights up the world. It constructs this vision for you. Most people know, for example, that colors don't actually exist in the outside world. There's only different wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation, and your brain interprets those as color. But there are many visual illusions that go a long way in teaching us the degree to which what you see doesn't necessarily reflect reality. It only reflects what's sort of useful. And I think this is an important starting point, and I spend a chapter on it in the book to illustrate what it is we're even trying to explain and how little of reality we're actually seeing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll start with Matthew in Euless. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, how are you today?
Great, thanks.
Great. Hey, I really appreciate you guys having David on the show. I actually heard you on Fresh Air with Terry a month ago, went out and bought the book. I had a question for you in regards to some information you touched on in the book. In the book, you talk about species' ability to be able to assimilate different types of stimulus. Like, for instance, I think you talk about color blindness in mice or something, and then they can see color. Yeah. And just our species' brain, our ability of our brain to be able to assimilate new type of information. You talk about people who are born deaf and then learn to hear and how overwhelming it is for them, but how they can do it. My question is moving forward, you know, with humanity, what do you think is on the horizon for us as humans as far as being able to assimilate new types of information, either electronically or, you know, through different types of genetics or anything like that? I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks for your call.
Great. Thanks very much, Matthew. Yeah, that happens to be the topic of my next book called Live Wired, which comes out next year. And what Matthew's referring to is that even though we have particular senses like, you know, hearing and sight and touch, what's become clear now is that you can plug other sorts of information directly into the brain, and the brain will figure out how to wrap itself around that information. And this opens up a lot of technologies and techniques. So, for example, you can replace a sense that's gone away. If, let's say, your retina at the back of your eye has degenerated, you can put in a little retinal chip which collects up photons and sends electrical signals down the optic nerve, and you can come to see with it. Similarly, deaf people can have what's called a cochlear implant, which replaces the inner ear with a little electric, you know, signal generator that takes sound in and puts electricity in. But even more excitingly, you can replace senses. So you can take somebody who's blind and you can feed in information through their tongue. You can take a camera and, you know, collect up visual information and turn that into electrical signals on their tongue, and they can come to see with their tongue. Now, if that sounds crazy to be able to see with your tongue, just remember that the electrical signals coming into your brain through your tongue are just like electrical signals coming in through your eyes. We're just more used to the eyes. But in answer to Matthew's question in particular, where I see this all going, that's what I spend a lot of time in my next book. And the answer is we'll be able to plug new information streams directly into the brain. So, for example, you could plug in stock market data or weather data or lots of other things and experience that directly, have a direct perceptual experience of that. And I think, you know, 200 years from now, we'll look back at those of us in the 21st century and we'll say, my gosh, they had such a limited little window on the world.
So in the past, David, people might say if they had done something wrong, well, the devil made me do it. Today, with our understanding of neuroscience, we might say, well, my unconscious brain made me do it. What does all this do with regard to criminal culpability?
Well, the background is this. It turns out that the way any individual brain comes about is by a very complicated interaction of genes and environment. So you come to the table with a certain set of genes, and then everything that happens to you, including in the womb, the chemicals that you get, and every child experience you have, and the toxins in the air when you're a child, or if you have lead paint on the wall, if you're abused as a child, whatever, everything that happens to you, these interact with your genes to regulate the expression of your genes, so that some genes go up, some go down, and so on. And what this means is that the trajectory of your brain development is determined by these very complicated factors of nature intertwining with nurture. And the end result is that all brains are very different, and they have completely different capacities and different imaginations and different capacities to imagine, different abilities to simulate possible futures and appreciate the consequences and so on. And taking credit or blame for your brain would be essentially like taking credit for having normal color vision or blame for being colorblind. It doesn't really make sense, right? It's just what you have biologically. Okay, the problem is, of course, we have a system where when people commit crimes, we need to hold them responsible for something. I think the whole issue boils down to blameworthiness is the wrong question for us to be asking. And that's the question that our system is always stuck in nowadays. We look at a criminal in front of the bench, and we say, okay, well, this guy had drug abuse, he had child abuse, he had these genes. Was it his fault or was it his biology's fault? But the problem is, those questions are inseparable. We never will be able to know enough to answer that question. And so, as a result, my recommendation on this has been to throw the blameworthiness question out the window. It doesn't matter how the brain in front of the bench got there. We'll never be able to know. All we need to do is have a forward-looking legal system. This is the way to make this whole system brain compatible, where you say, look, what do we do from here? Can we modulate the sentencing based on future dangerousness? Can we offer ideas for rehabilitation? Do we need to lock this person away, possibly forever? Fine. But the key is you have a tailored, customized system that's evidence-based, that's based on what we can tell about somebody's brain. So just to summarize this, the legal system now has this myth of equality built into it, where they assume that all brains are equal in terms of their capacities for decision-making and impulse control and so on. And it's a very nice idea, but it's demonstrably incorrect. And so what you really want to have is a system that admits, okay, look, brains are quite different, and some people we can help. Some people we can come up with really new, good strategies to help. Other people, unfortunately, we can't, and everywhere in between. And some people are more dangerous than others. Some people are really bad seeds. Other people aren't, and everywhere in between. And what we need is a system where we can look at that and have customization.
So should we also consider no longer rewarding people with Oscars and Nobel Prizes and Pulitzers?
That's interesting. No, those things actually serve as good motivators. I mean, it makes sense to, these are things that help people actualize their potential. Mm-hmm. But it clearly is the case that not everybody has the capacity to win a Nobel Prize or the MVP award in the NFL or the whatever it is, because, you know, people come to the table with very different amounts of talent. There's been a very sort of nice idea around for a while that anybody can practice hard enough and be great at something, but it's simply not true. I mean, I don't have the same wingspan as Michael Phelps, and so I'm just never going to be able to beat him swimming, even if I've got all the heart and soul in the world at it. So, you know, people are as different on the inside as they are on the outside.
I bet you could beat Michael Phelps on the SAT, though.
Yeah, it turns out, you know, the analogy that I've been using lately is that brains are like fingerprints in the sense that they're kind of alike, but they're really different in detail.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak this time with Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call. This is a fascinating topic, and I look forward to reading your book, David. And when I reflect upon this idea or concept myself, it's occurred to me that when I'm honest with myself, I have no idea why I've done something that I've done or why I've chosen a particular path. So I've kind of gotten onto this thing. My question for you is, and it's kind of implicit in some of the things you've discussed, is the concept of free will. And I know that that's something that we all hold near and dear to our heart, but it just seems as though we're a product of either nurtured nature, a combination of one of the two, maybe some cases more than the other. But this concept of free will is really a figment of our imagination, and I'd like to hear you comment on that and listen to you off the phone.
Thanks.
Thanks very much, Bob. Here's what I think about free will. We don't actually have the killer experiment in science to rule it in or out definitively. There are lots of reasons to think that we do not have free will. Essentially, what that comes down to is when we look at the brain, we see that every part of the brain is connected in a big network to every other part of the brain. So what you have is that everything's getting driven by everything else. And therefore, it's not clear where this ghost in the machine would slip in to be able to influence the physical system. I mean, somehow, in order to change behavior, the brain itself needs to get changed, and it's not clear how something non-physical can interact with something physical. So that's why a lot of neuroscientists believe we don't have free will. On the other hand, we might have something like free will, but our science is too young to understand how that could work or what that could mean. So what I conclude in the book is we may or may not have free will, but if we do, the key point is that it is much smaller than anyone has really thought about. In other words, if we have free will, it is very constrained in what it can do. So imagine taking your brain and Ted Bundy's brain, the serial murderer. You know, you guys have very different brains because of your entire history of genes and environment. Even if there is a little bit of free will that rides on top of the system in a way that we don't understand scientifically, you can't use your free will to make yourself like him, and he can't use his free will to make himself the way that you are. What that means is that there's only a little bit of play in the wheel. He's on one trajectory, you're on a different trajectory, and so if we do have free will at all, it's really not very powerful.
I'm not being totally facetious here. Do you think this is in part the reason why, for example, on Capitol Hill, Democrats and Republicans simply cannot understand where each other is coming from?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, what we find when you look at the human species, you find that people are very different. And this includes things like how you see the world and your political opinions and whether you empathize a lot with the stranger or feel like the stranger should pick himself up by his bootstraps and, you know, get going. And what happens is if that's the way your brain is and that's the way you see the world, it's really hard for somebody else to talk you out of that because it's just not compatible with the way you're seeing it in exactly the same way that you can't really imagine what it's like to be Ted Bundy or Anders Breivik in Norway. I mean, all of us hold political opinions that we might even feel passionately about, but my God, what does it take to be an Anders Breivik? Well, the answer is you can't ever get into his shoes. Actually, part of what got me interested in neuroscience is my father is a forensic psychiatrist and dealt with all the major mass murder cases in the Southwest. And when I was growing up and would hear about these cases, what I learned from my father is you can't put yourself in these guys' shoes. I mean, you can't think, oh, well, that guy surely must regret what he's done, because he simply doesn't. His brain is too different from yours.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Carrollton and speak with Lawrence. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi. Yes, I want to just make a quick comment before I ask my question or statement. It sounds, to some degree, like your science, your research is edging up on the Ayurvedic principles of India. But I wanted to just make a comment. I know that babies, when they hear language, often will repeat it back both forwards and backwards. And if you couple that with the idea that we always know deep down when we're lying, you know, later in life, there's been some kind of websites lately that have been talking about reverse speech, where there are statements in our forward sentences, you know, we're speaking forward, there are statements when you play certain passages backwards, there are statements there of some version of truth or something. You know, they have it for some of our presidents and, you know, people like that. I just was curious about your comments relating to that.
Have you heard anything about that, David?
I'm afraid I've never heard of anything like that, and I'm sorry to say that I'm a little skeptical of the of that. You know what, though, Lawrence? I'll look it up offline and see if I can find anything. But I would be really surprised, because if it were true, that would be the kind of thing that would be in all the scientific journals, and people would be jumping on, you know, trying to figure out how that could be true. Because that would be a real game changer if that were true.
Talk about how our unconscious brains influence our taste. I was interested to read that the more you're exposed to something, ultimately the fonder you become of it. And as someone who works on the radio and has been here for almost 5 years, I was very happy to read that.
Yeah, right. There are various illusions. I mean, things that have been noted in the literature. One's called the familiarity effect. So, yeah, if I show you, let's say, several faces and photographs, and then I come back later and I show you some other photographs, and some are overlapping what I showed you before, you'll prefer the faces that you've seen before, even when you're consciously unaware that you've seen them before.
Hmm.
So things that are familiar to us, we just like better, even if we don't even know that they're familiar. There's a related issue called the illusion of truth effect, which is if you have heard a statement before, you're more likely to believe it's true. So, for example, if I were to give you a whole bunch of statements and you rate them as true or false, and then I bring you back a month later and I give you a bunch more statements with a little bit of overlap with what you saw before, you're more likely to rate a false statement as true the second time you're seeing it, just because you've seen it before, even if you don't consciously remember ever having seen it. This is, of course, the basis for lots of things in advertising. We neuroscientists are just catching up with what advertisers have known forever.
Dr. David Eagleman is my guest. He's a neuroscientist who directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. His new book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Dr. David Eagleman. He's director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine and author of the new book Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Let's go next to Oak Point and speak with Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question specifically about a foreign language acquisition. You were talking earlier about learning to play a guitar, for example. And there's some certain similarities, the rote repetition that's involved. But as a language instructor, could you, could you tell me anything new that I could use or how the brain functions with second language acquisition?
The general thing that we know about automatizing anything is that all the repetition in the world is not terribly effective unless you have the right cocktail of chemicals going on in the brain, unless you have the right neurotransmitters present. And the way to have those is if the reward system is involved, or more generally, if curiosity and attention are involved. And so this is probably something you already know, but the point is that automatizing doesn't happen for free. The student needs to care. The student needs to have something that ties him or her in emotionally to achieving the goal of learning that second language.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will talk to Robert in Plano. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I'd like to say that I enjoyed your book some that my daughter introduced me to. I'm glad that you're on again.
Thank you.
I want to go back to free will. I like the way you handled it and the way you framed it, and I definitely disagree with Bob from Fort Worth earlier when he said, you know, that he thinks free will is a figment of our imagination. You said that it was difficult to measure, so science has problems with it, but you talked about a trajectory of a person's life. And so I think that free will is more of an accumulation of decisions. So instead of being a passive player, you know, we choose our habits, and at any moment it manifests itself in a decision. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, the way we often think about free will, whatever that is, and if it exists, the way we think about it is something that in the moment you can use it to decide, you know, given the choice of the chocolate cakes in front of you, do you eat it or not? Your free will is the thing that allows you to navigate that decision. And for people who think that free will doesn't exist, the idea would be actually what navigates the decision is your entire history up to that moment of your genes and your environment. And so if you rewound history 1,000 times, you'd make the same decision now every time because you don't have free will. For the people who do believe you have free will, the idea is that somehow you still have this extra, this extra thing that you can use. I think I have to think a little bit more about what you would mean about it being a history of all your decisions, how that would be free will. I'm afraid I have to think about that one a little more, because the way that we usually think about free will is in the moment it's the thing that allows you to tip one way or the other.
You know, David, I prefer to think that I have free will, and yet I have to say I find it a little thrilling to imagine that there is a computer that is big enough to handle all of the input of every bit of all of our genes and every experience we have, and that being able at some point in the distant future to predict every single action. I think that's really interesting to imagine.
Yeah, and of course the important part to keep in mind there is that the way you act, the decisions you make, all of that's embedded in a big social fabric. So every interaction that you have moment to moment changes your trajectory and changes what you're going to do next. And so what that means is if you looked at any individual brain, you'd have no real capacity to predict into the future. Even if we understood all the details of the computer all the way down, you wouldn't be able to really predict what somebody's going to do, because it depends on what everybody else on the planet does also, right? Because who you interact with, who you run into, the opportunities you're presented with, the, you know, all of those things change your actions too.
So that if I just went swimsuit shopping with a svelte friend, I might decide not to have that chocolate cake. And yet if I were just commiserating with someone else, then it wouldn't be so bad.
That's right. And so that's a great example of, you know, how your recent history would influence your current decision. But it's also the case that your near future influences, the direction of your trajectory. And this is why I just want to mention, sometimes people feel like, look, if you know a lot about brains and behavior, maybe we'd reach a point where we do this pre-crime thing where we say who's going to commit a crime and who's not. And it turns out that can never happen, because life is far too complicated and crime is circumstantial. And so you can have a very particular kind of brain, but depending on what social context you put that brain in, you get very different behaviors out of it. So, for example, you know, somebody with a psychopathic brain who's in a big, bad, rough neighborhood might end up, you know, doing violent, bad behaviors. But you put that same brain on Wall Street, and he might become a very successful CEO there. Or you put that brain that brain can become a surgeon and be a really good surgeon, even given the same, you know, aggressiveness and lack of empathy and so on. So what that means is the context that a brain finds itself in is a big part of the trajectory it goes on.
But you have no psychopathic surgeons at Baylor College of Medicine, I trust.
Well, I won't say anything in case I end up in the surgery suite at some point. Yeah.
Look, is there any reason to worry, though? Let's leave aside the question of sort of, you know, pre-imprisoning people for crimes they might commit, but as we have this growing ability to classify brains according to capacity and to function, I mean, could we find ourselves in a world in which it's easy to justify classifying human beings? And, you know, these people are elite and these people deserve second-class status based on the functioning of their brains alone.
It's a great question. Let me make a couple of points here. One is that it's not so much a classification into categories, because everything we know about the brain shows that it's on a continuum instead of categorical. And in fact, the new version of what's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that psychiatrists use, mm-hmm. The new version gets rid of these category boundaries and instead says, look, you know, it's not that you have schizophrenia or you don't, but it's that you can be anywhere along the spectrum. And, of course, with autism, it's already called the autistic spectrum disorder, where you can be anywhere along there. So that's the first point. But the second point is, it really is the case that brains exist on these spectra along any axis that you measure. Some people, if you go visit a prison, some of these guys are really, really dangerous. They're really bad seeds, and you don't want them back out on the streets. Other of these guys are perfectly fine, and they ended up there based on some, you know, series of circumstances, but they don't have much in the way of future dangerousness. And, of course, everywhere in between on a continuum. And so it actually would be quite silly for us to imagine that everybody's equal and that these guys should have exactly the same sentence and get out at the same time, because it is the case that we do need to treat people differently. And, you know, in some sense, the legal system already does this. I mean, take a guy like Anders Breivik, the guy in Oslo who just shot all these people. You know, you wouldn't want to say, well, he's exactly the same as this other guy that found himself in a bad situation when he lost his job or something.
You know, it's interesting, though. I was reading a piece, and now I can't remember exactly where I saw it, but about the penal system in Norway and how different it is. I don't know if you happen to see anything about that.
I know all about that, yeah.
Yeah, can you talk about that just for a minute, based on what we've been discussing about crime and punishment earlier in the hour?
Yeah, you know, the general story is that Norway is a much more lenient system, and when they build prisons, they have it full of IKEA furniture, and it's a nice place, and you have personal weight trainers, and you go on hikes, and it's a completely different ball game there. As a result, their rate of return to prison is much less than ours. So the American prisons are very criminogenic, meaning when you come out of that prison, you're pretty likely to go back, because we've broken your social circles, we've limited your opportunities for employment, all sorts of other things, and so you end up committing more crime. So their system is actually pretty good. Nonetheless, it is the case that, you know, even a Norwegian brain can be very pathological, like Anders Breivik's. And so in a case like that, they're going to end up locking him up forever. They happen to have a maximum prison term of 21 years, but they can keep adding five-year terms on top of that indefinitely, and that's almost certainly what's going to happen in his case.
If you're determined to be dangerous to society.
That's right. You know, and in some sense, the Norwegian system says at the end of 21 years, if you're still judged to be dangerous, we'll give you five more years. But I'll bet that even if Anders Breivik comes out after 21 years and says, you know what, I have completely changed my ways and I'm not dangerous anymore, even if they believe him, I'll bet they're still going to lock him up just to slake the public bloodlust. Because for better or worse, an important part of the punishment system has to do with satisfying a sense of justice. And so even though in my ideal system it would only be about future dangerousness, in reality there's this other component involved.
By the way, for people who want to check into this, Foreign Policy Magazine online has a rundown of the current Norwegian justice system. The piece, by the way, does take an angle and assumes that this is not the right way to do things, but the information contained within it is correct if you want to look it up. Let's take one more quick call here. We'll go to Hugh in Burleson. Hello, Hugh.
Hi there. This is a very interesting conversation. One of the reasons I listen to KERA and NPR. I'm a trauma therapist and work with post-traumatic stress disorder. My question is, if we look at things in terms of the new DSM 5 in terms of continuums, and we also look at behavioral therapy, which is rooted in very, very specific core-centered stuff, and in my experience, even in looking at dissociative stuff where people have a hierarchy of awareness, these things don't seem to match up for me. And I'm just wondering if psychology may not be going in the wrong direction sometimes in dealing with a hierarchy of a presence, whether cognitive or subconscious. And I just wanted to get your take on that.
Thanks for that question. Well, it turns out that things like cognitive behavioral therapy, as you know, are successful. They're among the most successful psychological approaches around. And I think the way to understand them from a neural point of view is that it's your long-term decision-making mechanisms are essentially contracting with your short-term impulses. And so what people do, I spent some time in the book talking about this because I find it such a fascinating issue, is how people negotiate with themselves and make themselves the kind of person that at least some part of their brain wants them to be. So let's say you're Mel Gibson and you're trying to break your alcoholism. The first thing you do is you get rid of all the alcohol in the house, right? Because you know when there's a battle between short and long-term decision-making systems, if there's alcohol in front of you, you're going to lose. And so the idea with cognitive behavioral therapy or things like it is you figure out what your temptations are. You figure out how to override those with long-term reflective decision-making. And so I think those things do make sense from a neural point of view, because what it is you're learning how to structure some parts of your brain to deal with other parts of your brain.
Can other animals trust their senses to a greater degree than we can?
Presumably not. What's interesting is that each animal has its own little view on the world. So we happen to pick up on a very particular slice of electromagnetic radiation, and we call that visible light. Mm-hmm. And we pick up on air compression waves in a certain range, and that's our hearing, and so on. But, you know, if you're a tick, then you pick up on butyric acid and temperature. And if you're the ghost fish, you pick up on electrical fields instead. And if you're a pit viper, then you pick up on infrared. And if you're a honeybee, you pick up on ultraviolet light and things like this. So it turns out that different animals are tapping into different energy sources in the world and presumably have a very different reality than we do. There's no reason to assume that it's more or less trustworthy. It's just picking up on stuff that has evolutionary usefulness to them.
Are there any specific ways that we can, you know, you talked about the fact that our unconscious mind has a lot to do with the formulation of what feel like new ideas to us. Can we do things to prime ourselves to come up with novel ways of thinking?
You know, one of the most important things that's been happening in neuroscience is this recognition that it's really important to always get novel experience, to get new experiences, because essentially what your brain's doing is figuring out how to make new roadways between different parts of the brain, roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. And so as people get older and they stop getting lots of cognitive input, it's really important for them to seek that out and make sure that they're exercising their brain and keeping cognitively fit. Because otherwise, when the brain starts to degenerate, when the tissue starts degenerating, you know, the brain doesn't have sort of alternate roadways to solve problems. And that's when you see people decline cognitively.
Dr. David Eagleman is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action and of the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine. His newest book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for being here, and make sure you come back when that next book is out.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.